As Robin said, my name is Dan Cork. I'm a study director with the Committee on National Statistics at the National Academy of Sciences National Research Council in Washington. I'm talking today about the U.S. Census, a history of challenges. Your website said I had to put this disclaimer up front there. I have no financial relationships to disclose. This being a talk about the census, I'm familiar with the concept of a mandatory response, so you know, there it is. I'll go you one better, match that to the disclaimer with the obligatory disclaimer I have to make, which is that unless I'm explicitly citing a previous study or a panel's work, the opinions expressed here are my own and not the NRC's, the Academy's, any panels, or anyone else's. These are observations, though, drawn from having watched things in census world for about the past 15 years as a study director with CNSTAT. I've been staff member or study director on nearly all of the continuous census or ACS studies we've had in operation since 2000. And let me jump ahead and cut to the chase a little bit, a long story short. This session's title is Threats to the Mission of Public Health as Governments Dismantle / Erode the Census, and my basic arguments are twofold. First, in the U.S. case, the census, quote-unquote, is in relatively little danger of being either severely dismantled or eroded, but the detailed American Community Survey, the ACS, is. The ACS contains the detailed sociodemographic and economic content that was previously on the census long-form samples for several decades. The second leg of the argument that I make is that what looks like dismantling or erosion is not a new or unique or sudden threat, but rather a longer-term systemic flaw in the way Americans have structured our particular statistical system. The census itself isn't out of the woods. There's always a need for increase in funding during the mid-decade in order to make census tests most effective and to achieve real change in census methodology. And given our budget travails, that's a little bit difficult. But the ACS's woes are, again, much more severe, it's much more fragile, and I argue it's primarily a byproduct of a lifelong identity crisis, which is most simply put as the ACS is and is not the census, quote-unquote. I'll get to that in a little bit, but first off, go way, way, way back to 1790, a little bit before then. The Constitution gave the mandate for the decennial census in the U.S. in Article 1, Section 2, requiring the actual enumeration of residents on a decennial basis, quote, in such manner as they, Congress, shall by law direct, unquote. Congress first so directed in the Act of March 1, 1790. The remarkable thing about that piece of legislation is that key aspects of it remain in force today and have carried through all the way through 2010. Mandatory response to census questions, subject to a fine, and by referencing the usual place of abode as where a person's or a household or a family should be counted, setting a de jure residence standard for the census. But the 1790 census, which involved sending the marshals out on horseback, also included public disagreements over the extent of the final count by both the President, George Washington, and Thomas Jefferson, who as Secretary of State was technically the first census director. I've included Jefferson's quote there, ballparking the number of omissions as about 4 million, and agreeing that the omissions made in 1790 was great. So even with the very first decennial census, in terms of quality or arguments about the quality, we're off to the races. Over the course of the next century, there's two basic trends going on in the decennial census. One is towards more methodological specificity, getting beyond just sending out the marshals on horseback and giving structure to what the enumerators wind up doing. So in 1820 was the first formal language requiring a personal visit at every dwelling house. By 1850, that had evolved into the first formal set of enumerator instructions, and based on problems in the previous census, the first two residence rules for the census on the counting of college students and marine vessel crews respectively. So that's one trend toward methodological specificity. The other trend going on over the course of the 19th century was dramatic expansion in scope. The 1790 census itself tiptoed over the line of a strict headcount called for by the Constitution. The tiptoeing had ended by the 1800 census, and over the course of the 19th century, the scope of inquiry that Congress added to the census with each new 10-year cycle continued to expand almost unchecked. 1820, occupation and industry, disability, military pensions, the nation's first crime statistics emerging in 1850, coming from prisoner counts, finally sort of distilled into this phrase from the 1840 census that got carried over in several other decades' bills, trying to ask questions about all such information as will exhibit a full view of the pursuits, industry, education, and resources of the country. A very large mandate indeed. I mention this history partly as a contrast with other nations' norms. Other countries typically have a Statistics Act, which defines a national statistics office, if not a full statistical system. And most other countries that still conduct censuses in the traditional way have that census reauthorized in a Census Act for each cycle. The U.S. has done things differently. Again, over that period of the 19th century and entering into the 20th, the massive amount of content was bundled into the census, culminating in the creation of a permanent Census Bureau. But since the turn of the 20th century, the American reaction to a need for more detailed data on a specific area of inquiry like health, like justice, like energy, is to form a new statistical unit elsewhere in government. The upshot of all this is that in the U.S., there is no regularly updated Statistics Act. Indeed, our National Statistical Office is technically the Office of Management and Budget, with relatively weak coordination authority, and there is no regularly updated Census Act. In fact, the law that governed the 1930 census was reused to authorize the 1940 and 1950 censuses, and that's what got codified in 1954 as Title 13, which still governs the conduct of the census today. Again, that's in broad strokes, and in similarly broad strokes, Title 13 has remained relatively stable to this day. Changes have been made, not always helpful, and so you have a Title 13 that multiple times suggests the use of sampling and multiple times suggests collecting and using administrative records type data from other governments or other federal agencies, but no specifics on how or to what extent those would be permitted. I want to just briefly mention 1964, the most seismic change made to Title 13 since codification in 1954 was a simple deletion, a one-line bill that struck the requirement that enumerators have to personally visit every dwelling house. That had a good side in that it enabled a primarily mail-out, mail-back methodology, which has been used in every census since 1970. It had the drawback of eliminating the closest thing to a specific direction on how the census should be conducted, as existed in Title 13. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit to sort of the apex of politics in the census, which was the 2000 census. By that point, statistical methodology had developed to the point where our panels and the Census Bureau advocated the use of sampling for non-response follow-up, of not going after every household relentlessly, but sampling some of the non-respondents. Congress forbade the use of sampling in a 1997 appropriations rider. That led to a veto. In January 1999, as the census was getting ready in its last year before the 2000 census had to get underway, the Supreme Court came in and struck down sampling-based methods for generating the state-level apportionment counts, which prompted a very quick and a very costly redesign. 2000 was an incredibly toxic environment. Very sharp politics, separate monitoring boards on the congressional and executive sides, heated debate, numerous oversight hearings, so on and so forth. And coming out of that crucible of 2000, in early planning for 2010, the American Community Survey emerged as one possible solution to a problem that had cropped up over the past several decades. The data quality of the long-form sample, that roughly 1 in 6 sample that had been used in censuses since the 1940, had never been spectacular and had gotten worse over time. Yet it still sort of carried the imprimatur of accuracy from being, quote-unquote, the census. The bargain that was struck in 2010 was to disentangle, to decouple the long-form content from the census, shunt it off into what was then a pilot American Community Survey, and let it develop on its own, thus making the 2010 census a short-form-only affair. I'm going to skip over the remainder of comments on the 2010 period, other than to say that direction was taken. The Census Bureau took other steps in 2010 in terms of trying to modernize technology that did not work out as well. The good news is that having stumbled a bit in 2010 with its handheld computing contract and other things, all evidence suggests that the Census Bureau is poised to make major change and successfully make that change in 2020, in particular making the internet hopefully the modal channel for response and a climate where administrative records may finally meaningfully be used as a supplement to major census operations. So, beginning the wind up here, in terms of the census and its potential for being eroded or degraded in the U.S., that Article 1, Section 2 clause is simultaneously a great crutch. It's that thing that can always be counted on to get the late-stage funding if things go awry. It's also a barrier to thinking in terms of collecting additional information. You have to hew towards as close to that sort of pure headcount as envisioned by the constitutional mandate as possible. But just its presence in the Constitution giving a mandate to the census is the ultimate trump card. So the census itself will endure. The ACS, unfortunately, lacks anything close to such a trump card. Again, our term Title 13 inherits from the law that authorized the 1930 census. So neither the long-form samples from 1940 to 2000 nor the ACS were explicitly authorized in law. You have to cobble together points of Title 13, the Secretary's authority to ask what questions they might like, authority for generating interim census data, a clause that was added in 1976 on mid-decade census authority, in order to legally, quote-unquote, justify the American Community Survey. That bargain that was struck of making the ACS the replacement for the long form also created sharp expectations. It tethered the ACS to the long form in the sense that it had to fulfill all the roles that the long form did. And that hinders creativity on the use of the ACS as a data or estimation tool, which has its own unique properties. And unfortunately, the Census Bureau was embarrassingly late to the game in assessing, cultivating, and leveraging its own ACS user database, or its own ACS user base. So what to do? I list four things here, and the and-ors are very deliberate because I don't know what combination of them is the most effective. But until there's either a clear mandate for the ACS in law and or a vocal or influential user constituency and or we rethink the ways that you ask the questions that always get lampooned as being particularly embarrassing or sensitive, the indoor plumbing, the disability questions, so on and so forth, and or there's a resurgence in legislative curiosity akin to what happened in the 19th century of actual genuine interest in collecting data on topics of interest, the ACS is an incredibly fragile ground. To wit, in the course of a half hour in May 2012, a sequence of 2 5-minute votes on the appropriations bill for commerce, justice, science, the House of Representatives voted first to make the ACS voluntary response and then turned around and passed the rider that would prohibit funding for the ACS altogether. We haven't had that debate in the U.S. on the ACS as a whole. Instead, we have this governing by appropriations potshot, and as long as you have a relatively fragile base without a clear mandate, it's always going to be that attractive target for the one-line appropriations rider. Likewise, in the currently stalled 2015 appropriations bill, the House passed its version with a voluntary ACS amendment. So, this is my last slide. My personal take, it was mentioned outside, I believe, but you may be aware that the Census Bureau currently has a Federal Register notice posted, the ACS content review, re-examining some of the questions. There's a comment period on that. The marital history questions are on the chopping block, along with the field of degree and one housing question. My own personal take on the ACS content review is that it's fundamentally flawed. It is looking for and requiring questions to have an explicit legal or regulatory mandate, ideally in the form of, thou shalt use the ACS to produce measure on this, all in a program that itself doesn't have a firm, explicit legal justification or mandate. To my mind, the single best thing that you can do to support the ACS, or the census in that matter, but particularly the ACS, is to use the ACS and to properly cite the ACS, not just as Census Bureau data or census data generically, but explicitly making the case for where the ACS data was used, where ACS data done properly could have produced even better results. But it's these kind of case studies in public health and private sector business, again, getting to that user constituency question that to me is going to be important in making the case for. Sometimes you have to ask survey questions because the nation needs to know. And sometimes you need to ask it on the ACS because that's either the best, the most efficient, the least burdensome, whatever the appropriate metric is to get that type of information. No one relishes the idea of throwing open Title 13 entirely or going back to census bills every 10 years. I don't particularly relish that, but I also do know that after 80 plus years, just about anything is worth reopening and taking a look. Those are my remarks.